You're with Truth News. It's Wednesday, the 29th of July, 2009. I'm Hereward Fenton, your host, and tonight we are presenting a special. We're going to devote the entire show to a very important question, a very important issue, although some of our listeners may question that. They may say it's not a worthwhile subject to be focusing a show on. I disagree. I think it is important. And I'm not taking sides here. I'm not saying that I know the answer. I'm not saying it is one way or the other. But the question itself is important. And it doesn't tend to get a fair shake in the mainstream news. And of course, from the intro music there, you can probably guess what we're talking about. It's the Apollo moon landings. Being the anniversary of the Apollo moon landings last week, there has been a fair amount of news about the event being the 40th anniversary, and also the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter sending back its first images from the moon. Now, where I come in on this is I've really not hadn't done much investigation of the Apollo moon hoax claims. I was interested in the subject after I heard the reports of the NASA images coming back. I went and had a look, and gee, you know, all I could see were these blurry white, images that are a few pixels, you know. And they were talking on the news with a whole lot of ballyhoo on the news that this was like amazing imagery. And that always, you know, when I see stuff on the news or hear stuff on the news that doesn't match what the actual information is, it always gets me questioning. So, I've watched a few of these documentaries now. And in the course of my research, I came in touch with an Australian man by the name of Jarrah White. And I got in touch with Jarrah, and I've now got him on the show tonight. Jarrah has produced an amazing set of YouTube videos, which are very detailed, and they cover a lot of aspects of the moon landings. You know, there's photographic analysis, there's analysis of some questions of physics, questions of jet rocket engines, and what they can and can't do. So I'd like to welcome Jarrah to the show. Jarrah, welcome.
It's a pleasure being here.
Well, it's a great pleasure having you. I'd like to give you a chance to really expound your views, without being interrupted. But just before I do that, I want to give you my take on this whole thing from a gut level, okay? Because I have certain issues and certain questions about the Apollo moon landings, which are kind of, they don't depend on whether the photographic analysis is correct, or whether the evidence about the crater is correct, or whether the evidence about the image of the moon in the porthole was real or not. I've got really basic questions, and I'll just run them past you and for our audience's benefit. Firstly, we had, from 1967 through to 1972, from 1967 through to 1972, we had a series of missions which were labelled the Apollo missions. Now, in that time, so it said, we went to the moon, the Americans went to the moon 6 times. An amazing, incredible achievement, okay? And 6 times is a lot of times, you know. To do it 6 times, you get pretty good at it, and you improve, and you refine. And if you've done it 6 times, really, you should be able to continue doing it indefinitely, because you've already solved all the major technical problems. However, they never did it again, and no country has ever done it again. This really puzzles me. This bothers me, okay? Another thing that really bothers me is the fact that there is no independent verification. There is no photograph that's ever been taken from any telescope, from the Hubble or from an Earth-based telescope or from any of the orbiters that have been to the moon, that shows the Apollo landing sites. And apart from these images which we, you know, were trumpeted, that don't show you anything. Okay. This troubles me. It also troubles me that the Soviets never attempted to replicate what the Americans had done, considering the incredible propaganda value it would have had for them. And just to round that off, I just want to run through a few key events that were occurring in the world during the period of the Apollo missions. Mm-hmm. Okay. January 27, 1967, the first Apollo mission was destroyed by fire during a test and training exercise, and the commander of that mission and the other two were killed in the fire. Mm-hmm. In December 31, 1967, US forces in Vietnam reached nearly 500,000 troops. That was the maximum period of American involvement in the Vietnam War. The US deaths in the Vietnam War in that year were 11,000, and in the following year they were about the same. For the next few years, America was we had various events such as America was plunged into social chaos. We had Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4, 1968. The My Lai massacre, massive, loss of propaganda value for the United States. Hundreds of Vietnamese were killed by U.S. soldiers in March of 1968. In April 1968, Apollo 6 was launched. On June 5 of 1968. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. And during this time when Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated, there were riots right across America. There were student protests. Hundreds of thousands of people were on the streets. There was a civil rights movement. There was the Black Power movement. There was an absolutely massive attempt to control the social unrest that was going on. And then... But while all that was happening, the Apollo missions were just chugging along. We had July 1969, Apollo 11 successfully reached the moon. U.S. deaths for that year in Vietnam reached 11,000. Then we had, in that same year, we had student protesters shot by the police and, what do they call it? The American military, the National Guard, fired live rounds at students. Then the American presence in Vietnam started to drop off. We had more Apollo missions, and by 1972, the American presence in Vietnam had dropped down to 133,000. They were already in the withdrawal phase. Then really the Apollo missions ended there. That was the end of it. Okay, never repeated, never done again. Now, I just thought that information is interesting. It doesn't prove anything, but it certainly says something to me. The Americans had a whole lot to gain from the propaganda value of these missions. And
It helped as a distraction tactic from the wars in Vietnam, and also as a strategical bluff in the arms race with the Soviets. Certainly served that purpose.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, the propaganda value was just amazing, because it really did. It magnetized a whole generation, I was part of that generation as a kid who looked up to these astronauts as father figures, and it gave people something to hope for, something to live for. It was incredibly powerful. And all I can say is, I'll hand it over to you now, but all I can say is that if this story turns out to be fake, it's a total betrayal of a generation, and there's going to be hell to pay. So I actually don't want it to be fake. I want it to be real, okay? But I'm going to hand it over to you now, and, I'd just like you to maybe give us a background for how you got involved in this, and if you could actually give us your most concise, just think of boiling it down to bullet points for the audience, to give the most concise and succinct view of why you think that the official understanding of this is completely wrong.
Okay, well, I wasn't around during the time of the moon landings. I was born in the 80s, but I did look up to the astronauts as heroes, as icons. As a kid, I wanted to be the first man on Mars, and I spent my life studying astronomy. Later on, I hear about the Apollo moon landing hoax theory, and I think, well, could this be real? Could this be a fake? And so I start doing my own investigation on it. I became friends with Ralph Rene, the author of NASA Moon to America, shortly afterwards. I did my own investigation. I looked to all the pros and cons of the theory, and I quickly came to the conclusion that yes, this was all faked. The probably the most, there are actually three most major points, major compelling points that I can address to. Number one is radiation in space. In the beginning, when James Van Allen, he was the discoverer of the Van Allen radiation belts, these fields of radiation that surround the Earth. In the early 1950s, he was sending up rockoons, which is like a rocket with a weather balloon attached. The weather balloon goes up, and the rocket fires the rest of the way up into space. He'd have these Geiger counters inside them. Right? They'd always detect enormously high levels of radiation. Later on, he would do the same thing with satellites. Like, he put the Geiger counters in Explorer, in the Pioneer, in all these different spacecraft, and space probes and space satellites. All right, so. Every time they go up into the Van Allen radiation belts, which begin at about 1,000 kilometers above, these radiation levels would suddenly rapidly start to literally go through the roof, and then they just clunk back down to zero because there was just simply too much radiation for these instruments to cope with, and so they became jammed. Right? He sent one satellite up after another, and they all did the same thing. So then eventually he decided to start shielding his Geiger counters with lead. He put a millimeter of lead around the Geiger counters, and, you know, so they could continue to count. But even with the lead shield, the readings still turned out to be 10 to 100 rem per hour. Now, we use rem to measure how much radiation a person receives, you see. Now, you need 500 rem to kill a person. Right. Now, with the lead shield around the Geiger counters, the readings were 10 to 100 rem per hour. Even 100 rem is going to give you some radiation symptoms, right? Okay. And without this lead shield, the readings were anywhere from 312.5 rem per hour to 11,666 rem per hour. Now, I got that figure from E.E. Kovalev, who was the Soviet Union's radiation health officer. He had an article called Radiation Protection During Spaceflight. That was in the December 1983 Journal of Aviation, Space, and Environmental Medicine.
Okay.
Now, Van Allen, he had his own articles, one in Scientific American, March 1959, another one in Space World, December 1961. He clearly stated that a human being cannot survive this level of radiation, and that adequately shielding astronauts within that given time frame, you know, in the 60s, was beyond engineering capabilities. In fact, we can't even shield astronauts today from this type of radiation.
Could you just recap for a second what the actual range of those belts is in terms of, like, altitude above the Earth? Because that's kind of an important question that some people seem to be, well, they have different opinions on. So, like, when do they start and when do they end, and at what, you know, level are they at different...
All right, well, the inner belt begins at 1,000 kilometers above the Earth, and the outer belt ends at 25,000 kilometers above the Earth.
Okay. So 25,000 kilometers. So that's
That's where
right,
it ends.
Right. And the space shuttle and all manned missions apart from Apollo, what is their maximum altitude that they've reached?
Well, it's mostly about a few hundred kilometers. You know, it doesn't go into the Van Allen radiation belts. It stays well below that.
Okay.
There is a region that dips called the South Atlantic Anomaly. It's not as bad as the rest of the radiation belt, but satellites that go through it must have their instruments shut off before entering it because, you know, to protect them from the radiation, basically.
Okay.
And now, in fact, to adequately shield the astronauts, right, you need 2 meters of water shielding. A guy called John H. Molden, he was an astrophysicist for NASA, he wrote a book called Prospects for Interstellar Travel. Now, in his book, he proposed 2 meters of water shielding surrounding the entire spacecraft, right? And he states that with this shielding around the spacecraft, the radiation within the Van Allen belt would be 1 rem per day, which is 0.041 rem per hour. So that's great, but obviously you're not going to have a powerful enough rocket to lift that shielding into space.
Can I just ask, how long, according to the trajectory of the spacecraft, how long were they in this zone?
When you're in the Van Allen belts, basically what the plan is, right, when you go into space, you're about, you're going 17,000 miles per hour, you speed up to 25,000 miles per hour, and that flings you out of Earth orbit and towards the moon. Now, even at that speed, you'll spend an hour going through the radiation belts on the way to the moon, and another hour on the way back.
Okay, so an hour each way.
An hour each way.
Okay, and an hour's exposure is enough to cause serious physiological effects, yeah?
Yeah, in fact, you know, if at Remember, this is an unshielded dose. The minimum dose is 312.5 rem per hour. See, the astronauts, they didn't have any shielding. In fact, the aluminium that they used in the spacecraft would have even worsened the problem, because aluminium increases the risk of particle fragmentation. You see,
okay,
the radiation particles, they hit the aluminium and they shatter into a dangerous spray of secondary particles, and also electromagnetic waves, you know, such as X-rays and gamma rays, which would have even worsened the problem.
Okay.
Now, that's the number one major piece of evidence that was all faked. I haven't even gotten started on solar flares, but...
Okay, so the Van Allen belts is one of the most compelling piece of evidence, is it?
I'd say that is one of the most compelling.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
Another most compelling piece of evidence that it was all fake, right, as you might recall, on the Apollo missions, they allegedly brought back moon rocks.
Yes.
Right? Now, these moon rocks are often hyped about being the ultimate proof that men went to the moon, but in actuality, they're not proof that they went to the moon. They proved just the opposite. Recently, the European Space Agency, ESA, they launched their space probe, the Smart One. This was a probe to circle the moon, you know, and take pictures, and towards the end of that mission, right, it crashed into the near side of the moon and kicked up all this plumes of moon dust, you know, for scientists to analyze.
Yes.
When it did that, it turned out that the actual moon rocks are different to those that are actually, you know, they're different to the ones that they collected by on Apollo. Right, it was reported, quote,
okay,
by punching a 10-meter hole in the moon's surface, the probe has detected minerals different to the rocks gathered on the moon during moonwalks.
Right, right. So difference, yeah. And the difference, is it, you know, is there another explanation for the difference other than, you know, that they didn't come from the moon? Or?
Well, no one seems to be commenting on this now. Everyone's suddenly very quiet about this. Suddenly it was the bomb diggity in the news, then suddenly they just seem to have forgotten about it.
Okay, so it hasn't really been explained why they
exactly
were different. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most compelling pieces of evidence, that it was all faked. Then, of course, there is the Apollo 10 telecasts. So before Neil Armstrong's flight, there was the Apollo 10 mission, right?
Okay.
Now, this wasn't going to land on the moon. This was just, you know, orbiting around it, then coming back home again. Anyways, during the trips to the moon, the Apollo 10 crew, they sent back various telecasts, you know, showing the Earth viewed at a distance. All right, now, remember, this is supposed to be live TV footage. I have the raw footage of these telecasts, right?
Right.
And basically, in various instances, right, the camera is looking back at the Earth, right, and suddenly the camera will just cut from one angle to another.
Right.
And the audio is still, you know, running over these camera cuts, indicating that the audio is uncut, yet this video is edited. Right.
So okay,
that cannot happen in a live broadcast, especially with only the one camera, you know?
So they were cutting to, what, two completely different angle shots, or...
like 1 minute, say the Earth would be down at the bottom of the screen, and suddenly the camera would cut and the Earth is up at the top of the screen, or zoomed in closer, or whatever.
Okay, so there's some inconsistency there. Could that be explained by just, you know, post-editing, that they edited it later? Maybe they cut out some bad part of the film and just resplice the audio back into it? Is that...
No, this is the raw footage. I got this from...
Right.
Spacecraft Films, which is an organization run by Mark Gray, right? He sold these telecasts as the complete unedited, you know, raw footage, basically.
Okay.
Right? Not only did it turn out that these telecasts were edited, right? Basically, the only way this could have happened is if these telecasts were pre-filmed, edited together, and then broadcast with the ground-to-air communications dubbing the video, right?
Right.
Now,
right,
interestingly, right, although this is sold as the complete footage, right, when I was comparing the stuff with the official NASA transcript, you see they have a transcript of all the communications, you know, of every space flight they do, okay?
Okay.
Now, I was watching these telecasts, comparing them with the transcripts. Not only did it become that some of the footage was edited, right, there were pieces of existing footage missing in the so-called complete DVD set, right? So basically this guy, Mark Gray, was selling these telecasts as complete when he knew he was excluding footage. Right? We know this footage exists because the guys on the ground are saying, oh yeah, we've received this footage, we've got it, Madrid has got it.
Right.
Right. So clearly this footage exists, and yet Mark Gray is selling this half-assed version of the Apollo record as the uncut.
Okay.
Right? So basically I proved this in a video that I released. It was called Flagging the Gems, and What does the guy do? He flags copyright infringement against my video, even though this is public domain footage.
Really? So he forced you to take it down, did he?
Well, basically, he flagged copyright infringement against my videos that were on YouTube once, and he got my old YouTube account suspended.
Right, really?
Yeah, I've restarted my YouTube account, thankfully, right, and the Apollo 10 documentary is called Flagging the Gems. That can be viewed on livevideo.com.
Actually, I have watched some of that. I've live video. Yes, I've seen some of that. I couldn't... it was very long, and I didn't quite understand what I was supposed to be watching for. And I've also watched the one from Bart Sibrel's film where he's claiming that there was something funny going on in that the camera was not in front of the porthole but was like back, and then there's now I found that
Apollo.
A bit confusing, to be honest with you. I found that I wasn't clear enough in my mind what I was supposed to be looking at for it to mean anything to me. That's just my gut, you know, response to that. But
okay, well, let me break the ice.
Yeah,
In the Apollo 11 footage, that's the footage that Sibrel received.
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, the astronauts are supposed to be 130,000 miles out. Okay. They're looking back at the Earth, you know, viewed from a distance.
Yeah.
Right. Right. This is supposed to be the Earth, right?
Yeah.
Then after a while, they say, okay, bring the camera in for a TV shot. They switch the camera off, but then suddenly it pops back on again. You know, maybe they thought they turned it off, but it popped back on again. They're zooming out, and as they're zooming the camera out, an interior light comes into the shot.
Right.
They open up the aperture a bit, and what it turns out is that they're actually filming this picture, a transparency of the Earth, clipped up against the window, so that they've turned out the lights in the spacecraft and let the light on the other side of the window shine through the window and through the transparency to make it look like the Earth is viewed from a distance.
So what you're saying is that it was actually just like a photograph, a transparency photograph, stuck to the window. It wasn't even... I thought it was... He was saying that it was the Earth from near orbit, that they were actually in orbit.
Yeah, basically they're in they're in Earth orbit, right?
Yeah.
And they were just filming this transparency clip to the window to make it look like they're far away when in fact they were not.
Yeah, because if they were in near orbit, the whole window would be filled. You wouldn't be able to see the Earth. You'd just see clouds and stuff, wouldn't you? I mean,
In fact, when they're inside the spacecraft during the interior scenes, they pan the camera around the spacecraft. It looks briefly towards the hatch window, right? But rather than seeing the hatch, you know, filled with the black of space, we see it filled with a blue light, indicating that they're looking back at the Earth.
Now,
we know it's not the sunlight being refracted through the window because the sun was coming out through the window on the other side of the spacecraft.
Okay. You know what I think would be, like, good if someone could do a reenactment of that? Because I think the average person is going to have trouble understanding what was being claimed there. But now I'm getting it now. Like, you're saying that they're in the ship, they're in Earth orbit, but they just had this transparency that they brought with them. They stuck it up on the porthole, turned all the lights off, and then just had the camera at the back of the spaceship.
Yeah, back of the spacecraft, zooming in at this transparency as though they were filming the Earth viewed from a distance when there was just obviously a transparency. And those are the moon rocks, the radiation, and the Apollo 10 telecast. Those are the main 3 points that it was all faked. Now, you mentioned earlier that about the why no one has gone back and why there's no independent verification what was the other thing you mentioned? Well,
those are questions which, I mean, those are facts, though. You know, those are just facts, and they don't prove anything one way or the other, but they are certainly, the more you think about them, the more they puzzle you. Look,
I'll tell you something curious about that.
Yeah, yeah.
They often claim, whenever they ask, oh, why don't we go back to the moon? The excuse they give is always, oh, it's too expensive to go back, and yet they as you might already know, they're planning to build up the Orion program, the mission that will supposedly return astronauts to the moon.
Yes.
Well, they plan on launching the Orion spacecraft using shuttle-derived technology, like the Ares rocket that's going to be built from the shuttle's external tank and the solid rocket boosters, right? And in fact, they've even come up with a plan B for the Ares rockets. Try to imagine the you've seen the shuttle on the launch pad, right, with the shuttle, the external rockets, and the tank?
Yes.
Right? You've seen that? Well, try to imagine that, but take off the shuttle and put on this cigar-shaped shell which holds the lunar spacecraft inside. Basically, they plan on launching that into space with this shuttle technology.
Wow.
Either way, right, they've had this shuttle technology since the 80s, and in fact, the shuttle first went into planning stages back in 1969.
Right.
You know, the year of the moon landing, right?
So. Right.
given that they've had all this shuttle technology this whole time, right, if they've had this whole time and they could have returned to the moon using the shuttle technology, well, why didn't they do it sooner? They've always said it's, yeah, oh, it's budget. Well, you've had this technology, mate. Why don't you use it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, like when I was a kid, you know, we just assumed that by now there'd be like colonies on the moon, you know, like we would have thought by now there'd be cities on the moon. I mean, you know, if they went to the moon six times, 40 years later, it'd just be, you know, everyone would be there.
Yeah, there were many plans for many more elaborate space flights. You know, like they were, as soon as they had landed on the moon, they were talking about, you know, landing on Mars by 1982 and flying by Venus on the way home.
Yeah,
and
building
bases and stuff like that. But here's the thing, right? Of course, the main goal of the Apollo was to fake the moon missions to, you know, as a propaganda tactic, you know, to bluff, to make them seem like they had military superiority and be the first to land on the moon. Okay,
yeah,
we've completed that objective in Apollo 11. Now, how do we get out of it? Okay, so what they had later on, they had the Apollo 13 mission, the near disaster.
Yeah.
What that actually did it resulted in the cancellation of the Apollo flights. They had many more missions after Apollo 17 planned. They had Apollos 18, 19, and 20, and, you know, plans for the LAM truck, which would carry, you know, cargo to build a lunar base on the moon, that sort of stuff.
Sure.
Right. So what they did was that they managed to, they've completed the objective of Apollo 11. Now they managed to get out of it with Apollo 13. Because it resulted in the cancellation of the remaining moon flights. They had three more after that, but other than that, four more after that, but other than that, they had found a way out of it. And in the meantime, they managed to find one way or another to limit or degrade the amount of footage that they would have to fake, such as you might recall, on Apollo 11, they had the grainy black and white videos filmed off TV screens. Apollo 12 was to be the first time they brought a video camera to the moon. Oh, sorry, we pointed at the sun and we burnt out the Videocon tube. Then there was Apollo 13, in which they had to cancel the TV broadcast because, you know, to save power.
Right, okay. And
then there was Apollo 14, where they actually did bring the camera, but this time, oh, sorry, the landscape's overexposed. It was one story after another, basically.
That's interesting. Look, I'm just going to take a really quick break, and I'm going to fire a couple of questions at you of my own. Just hang on right there.
Okay.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, we're back with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm here with my guest Jarrah White, and we're discussing the moon landings and whether it really happened or whether it was all a big hoax. Jarrah, I've just got a couple of questions that have been on my mind having watched these documentaries. I've seen the one by Bart Sibrel, and I've seen the one that was on Fox, and I've watched a lot of your stuff. Now, a couple of things here. There are claims that are made that the actual sunlight on the moon would have been so hot that the boots of the astronauts should have melted. But then it's been pointed out to me that, well, they do a lot of moonwalks at the International Space Station, and they do that in full sunlight, and it seems to be okay. They don't just fry up. That's one thing I'm curious about, because I know that they have done quite a few moonwalks in the sunshine, because they've photographed it and stuff. Another question, of course, is the question about the crater under the landing module. That seems to me, I mean, I can't explain why there isn't one. I read some interesting stuff on a website which said that the reason why there's no crater under the landing module is because the dust was just kind of blown in a ballistic trajectory away from the landing site. The thrusters weren't that powerful either. But I've seen your stuff, which shows, you know, a fairly moderate jet thrust of something like 3,000 PSI, and it certainly cracks the concrete. Although that is in the Earth's atmosphere, it may be very different in an airless environment. It's a bit hard to know exactly how it would be in a vacuum. But I just wonder if you could address the question of the sun and the sun's energy, the sun's heat. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, the space shuttle suits that they use nowadays are a little bit different from the suits they had on Apollo. One thing is that they actually have on the shuttle suits they actually have a vacuum layer in the suits, you know, to try to limit the amount of heat getting through. But even on the Gemini flights, when the astronauts were walking in space,
yeah.
Right? This was before Apollo, right? The astronauts would get extremely hot doing very simple tasks. In fact, on Gemini 12,
right.
Buzz Aldrin, when he was walking in space, right, you know, during a daylight pass above the world, okay, he leaned back and nearly burned his back against an external zipper. You see, that had heated up from direct sunlight.
Okay.
Even though he was only on the daylight side, see, the orbit around the Earth takes about 90 minutes.
Okay.
Okay. You're roughly in there. On the daylight side half time, and roughly in the nighttime side the other half.
Sure,
okay?
You're in and out all the time. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And obviously, this guy nearly burnt his back against the external zipper of his spacesuit, right?
Okay.
And that's indicates how quickly things heat up rapidly.
Okay.
Then of course you got the lunar module itself. Okay. That has absolutely no insulation. In fact, the walls. Walls on the LEM were so delicate that if you took a pencil or your finger even and poked hard at it, you could stick your finger right through the outer wall of a spacecraft. It was only it was only the thickness of a few layers of aluminium foil.
That's incredible.
I didn't know that. This is what's supposed to be, you know, keeping these guys in shelter this whole time, you know, while they're sleeping in there. So, anyways, this is quite amusing. In fact, this is in direct sunlight. Remember, okay, these guys,
okay.
This whole side of the LEM is getting heated up by the thing. It has no insulation on it. Obviously, the heat's going to go inside through this aluminium into the atmosphere. You know, heat up all the air inside like an oven, right? Anyways,
yeah.
These guys are sitting in there. The astronauts, they're supposed to have a rest period, but you know, between moonwalks.
Yeah, sure.
Obviously, it was just the one moonwalk on Apollo 11. But anyways, they're sitting in there, right, trying to get some sleep, and. They claim, oh no, we couldn't get to sleep. It was too cold in there.
Right, right, okay. So, I mean, did they have a cooling? How did they cool it? Yeah, that's a good question. How did they keep the LEM cool? Was it?
It's called if you buy battery powered air conditioning units, but
right.
they only had about I think it was 126 volts worth of power on that spacecraft.
Okay, okay,
yeah. And on the during the moonwalks, right, they actually have a layer called the liquid cooling garment, in which water runs through tiny tubes to relieve metabolic heat from the skin, and then transfer it to a heat exchanger, where it's then blasted outside the spacesuit and freezes.
Okay.
Okay. In the,
yeah,
in the vacuum
yeah.
of space.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that would work until the water ran out, of course, and. My friend Ralph Rene did some calculations. He worked out that you'd need probably about 24 liters of water just to keep them cooled that whole time. Remember, they're on the moon for about two to four hours.
Sure.
2 to 7 hours, sorry. And even if you did have enough water in those spacesuits, right? You would have seen the jettison of the ice. You know, when the water is blasted outside. You know, outside the space, you would have seen all those little ice crystals flying around. You know, astronauts have reported that they've seen their urine when it's jettisoned outside the spacecraft. You know, they actually have to pee in a tube and it goes into a tank and then jettisoned out. You might have seen it in Apollo 13.
Yeah,
the movie. They comment on you can see these ice crystals. It would have been the same case with the water emissions.
Absolutely.
And yet we never saw any ice being jettisoned out of the spacesuits.
They should have sort of had a steamy appearance, should they? Or it's hard to imagine.
You would have seen the emissions from the spacesuits. You know,
yeah.
They would have sprayed out from the backpack.
Okay, that's a really interesting point which I hadn't come across before. Can you just speak to the crater issue, because that's actually the one that initially hooked me, because I can't figure it out.
Okay, what you got to understand, if your listeners, basically try to imagine the lunar module. Right? It has four landing legs spread out, and in between those legs, it has this large engine. The engine generates about 10,000 pounds of thrust, okay, and it throttles down to about 3,000 or 2,500 pounds of thrust during the landing. Right? This is what they used to land on the moon, allegedly. Now, the lunar module would have clearly dug a huge crater beneath the LEM. You would have seen this LEM sitting in this gigantic crater dug up by its engine. Okay, we have engines here on Earth which develop only, I think it was 300 pounds of thrust, 500 pounds of thrust, right? And these were built by Armadillo Aerospace. They were able to dig a hole through concrete. Okay, this was only at 500 pounds of thrust. Now, if 500 pounds of thrust can do that to concrete, imagine what it will do. What 3,000 pounds of thrust will do on the moon's surface. Remember, concrete is quite hard. You know, this is the
and that's demonstrated in one of your videos.
That's demonstrated in one of my videos. Yeah. It's Moonfaker, no crater.
Yeah.
Right. And then you got the obviously they would have dug a crater in the ground, and then you got here these claims that the vacuum of space reduced it to only 1.5 psi. Well, 1.5 psi, that's three times as powerful as a garden leaf blower. You know, you take a leaf blower on some loose rock and you see it blast all those pebbles away.
Okay.
And yet, in the Apollo videos, we can see pebbles directly underneath the engine bell, you know, loose matter underneath there.
Yeah.
They would have been easily blasted away by the engine.
Yeah, you'd imagine so. The only thing that makes me hesitate is the question of, in a vacuum, you know, obviously in the Earth's atmosphere, we've got the effect of the air itself. And so when you heat up air and you create a current, a convection current or whatever, that creates this bigger disturbance. But of course, in a vacuum, it's just the particles of the actual whatever's being ejected, the fuel particles, is only that physical impact of those particles, whatever they hit. And whatever they hit will be impacted in a kind of... Like with Newtonian mechanics, you know, it'll bounce.
I understand what you're getting at. There's no air, so obviously it can only move by physical contact with the plume. Well,
yeah.
the fact is during the actual landing, right, when the astronauts first report they're picking up some dust, you know, like when the dust when the engine is spraying all this dust everywhere, they were still 30 meters above the moon's surface. So clearly that plume has managed to reach the moon's surface from 30 meters above. That clearly demonstrates how far this thing will go down.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so that means that there was so they were 30 metres above the surface.
30 metres above when they first started picking up some dust.
Yeah, and I've listened to that where he says they're picking up some dust. Although apparently there's two versions of it. One says kicking, one says picking. But I listened to the audio off YouTube, and he definitely sounds like picking to me.
Yeah. Either way, it's definitely reaching the ground from that altitude.
Okay, absolutely, yeah. So there should have been a disturbance, and certainly in the photographs, it doesn't look like there's any kind of visual disturbance. Some people have claimed, the debunkers have claimed, well, there is, and there's some evidence of a discoloration. I don't know. I couldn't call it. That's a really, good summary of that particular issue. I think just something else that really comes to mind for me is this whole issue of getting to the moon, orbiting the moon, landing, and then taking off again. It's incredibly difficult. I mean, it's amazing if they did it, because it really was a very tricky thing to do. They have to get everything just right, don't they? I mean, they've got to get the fuel right. Now, according to one report I read, they were within 10 seconds of running out of fuel when they landed or something.
Yeah, I believe it was 30 seconds left of running out of fuel. When they got there, it was only about 15 seconds or so left.
Yeah, yeah, so they cut it fine, you know, and the story is, well, they did it. That was in Apollo 11.
Yeah.
One would assume in the later missions they didn't cut it so fine. I don't know. That's if it really happened, which we're debating here. So, of course... blast off from the moon. I've watched the video of that was shot from the moon surface, and you see that little thing shooting up like a jack in the box. My gut feeling is it doesn't look to me very convincing. That's all. It just has a funny look about it, but I don't know. You know, I'm not an expert.
Personally, I reckon that was probably filmed by lifting it up by a crane.
Okay.
Now they lifted it up by a crane. They had the camera panning up to the other crane. Just lifted it off this moon surface with this large crane, right?
Right.
And that's how they faked that. It's interesting to notice that you don't see any exhaust coming out of the lunar module.
No, well, that's true. That's one of the reasons why it doesn't look that convincing. It looks like it's on a spring or something. It just goes boing and just shoots straight up. Yeah.
Yeah. The typical explanation you get is usually that the plumes aren't supposed to produce any visible plume, and yet that's not what was claimed in the in Moonshotter, which was a book by Dick Slayton and Al Shepard. They specifically says it produces a, it should produce a glowing plasma gas.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, who's ever heard of an invisible glowing gas?
It's unusual, yeah. I certainly, it'd be a new one on me. Great stuff. Look, I think we're about ready to move into the second half now, where we're going to have a couple of two studio guests here are going to join the discussion. Are you okay to continue?
Sure.
We're just going to take a bit of a break for some music, and we're going to just have to fix up the two extra mics, but we shouldn't be too long. So I'll just put the music on, and we'll get right back to you at the end of the song.
Okay.
Cheers.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Okay, we're back with Truth News Radio Australia, and it's time for the second half of the show. Welcome back, Jarrah.
Mm-hmm. How's it going?
It's going good, going good. Welcome, Josh Jackson.
Mate, I'm back. It's what a great subject. I love tackling.
It's been good.
Especially with someone with so much knowledge like Jarrah here. It's really good to. Get people, as well as John Bursell here, we've got as well in the house, who's got a lot of knowledge.
We've got John Bursell, who
I'm a moon landing virgin, yeah. Who's been avoiding the subject for many, many years.
But John comes as an expert in a important field. I mean, he's an expert in jet engines, so they're not exactly rocket engines, but they're pretty, you know, got some similarities, I guess.
And well, John, jet engine runs on jet fuel and sucks all the air inside the machine, whereas the rocket engine that carries its own oxygen aboard, you know, its own oxidizer, rather than, you know, sucking the atmosphere's air inside it.
Absolutely, yeah, it's not a compressor. But that's it's been very interesting. I'm actually quite impressed with the way that you've tackle most of these subjects. I've noticed on the net that you've made a few mistakes along your way on your journey. The first question I had for you, actually, if I could take the first question,
yeah,
Heroid,
just go
was,
ahead. Go ahead.
What's your background? What's your qualifications? I'm going to be the bad man here that's going to call you out on a few things. So could you give us a bit of background on what qualifies you to comment on the moon landing?
Well, I have formal training in photography. I'm a formally trained photographer. I've had years of training in that field, and I've been able to find errors in various of the photographs taken by the astronauts.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. And you're an amateur astronomer, from what you've said earlier.
Yeah. I studied astronomy as a kid, and I've been studying it since, studying physics as well and everything else.
No worries, and that's just a general passion of yours, so you've pursued it due to those reasons. Why is it that you've decided to take the moon landing on? Like, I'm heavily involved in the 9/11 truth movement, and we have plenty of rock-solid forensic evidence plus physical evidence that proves our case, and we can't really get a hearing. But we're often said that we're people that don't believe that people landed on the moon. They often use that to bring disrepute to us. So what makes you want to get embroiled in a subject that comes with so many barbs and entanglements?
Well, as I said, when I was a kid, I wanted to be the first man to walk on Mars. You know, I had dreamed of becoming an astronaut, you know, when I grew up, and later on in life, I hear about the Apollo moon landing conspiracy, right? And so I decided to do my own investigation on that. And along the way, I came across all these websites that try to prove that the moon missions were real. But what these guys, what these webmasters actually do, rather than providing any valid evidence, what they do is they present this garbage, and in some cases, downright character assassination against anyone who even considers the idea that it was all faked, and even put words in their opponents' mouths. So basically, I decided eventually that, well, it's time for someone to stand up against these guys and show them what they really are.
Yeah, good on you, Joe, because we get the same with 9/11 truth, you know, or global warming, anything that we sort of look at empirical sort of facts, you know, scientific knowledge of you know, if you sort of present some of this really rock solid information, and people just start using character assassinations.
Although, you know, in some cases the researchers themselves don't do themselves any favors. Now, I kind of was a bit turned off when I saw Bart Sibrel's Astronauts Gone Wild. Now, okay. I didn't bring that up before because I thought it's sort of irrelevant, but I think that what he did has damaged his own credibility. Because he makes himself look like an idiot.
If I may give my two cents worth on that incident, yeah. No, I'm not justifying what he said. In fact, he actually publicly apologized to Buzz Aldrin for calling him a liar and a coward and a thief. Basically, what happened was that he had, as we discussed earlier, he received this footage from Apollo 11. After he received it sometime in, this was in 2000, I believe, he actually got in touch with Buzz Aldrin. You know, he just showed him this footage, you know, asking, you know, the question about, hey, what's going on here?
Sure.
You know, and Aldrin threatened to sue him if he showed the interview publicly, right? And so a couple of years later, that was in 2002, Aldrin had given an interview to a Japanese production company. You know, he was doing like a documentary or something about the moon missions. And they were going to bring Sibrel on as a surprise guest, you know, to face-to-face with Aldrin. And Sibrel, he brought his own camera crew there, you know, because, you know, he was trying to get him to swear on the Bible that he walked on the moon. You know, he thought about seeing how many of these guys would actually swear on a Bible. He said, here, I got, but would you like to swear on it, right? And Aldrin, he said, I know you'd like to get a lot of attention. And, well, this guy, Aldrin, he had just been paid $2,000, you know, to talk about something that he didn't do. Right, so that kind of made Sibrel angry, and he said, well, you're the one who's getting paid all this money, you know, to talk about something that you didn't do, so that makes you a thief. You know, and so basically they were like, the insults started to fly, hey, you're the attention seeker, well, you're the one who said you walked on the moon when you didn't. Okay, you're a coward and a liar and a thief, you know, the insults just started to fly, and then things eventually got physical.
So have any of them actually tried to sue him? Because I know I've watched his interviews with a few of them, and he's quite rude to a lot of them. Have any of them actually tried to sue him?
I'm not sure about that. He actually tried to ask Neil Armstrong a few questions. You know, he came to knock on his door to just ask a few questions. Say, can you explain this? Can you explain that? And Aldrin says, if you hang around my place any longer, I'll call the police.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably fair considering, you know, the pressure that those people have come under over the years of media scrutiny, etc. Now,
let's move on. That's a tough, tough.
It is. Now, I'd like to see...
Break, if I may just, if yes, I just get started, before the break, yeah. I mentioned that in Moonshot, a book by astronauts Al Shepard and Deke Slayton, they actually mentioned that you would have been able to see the plumes of the rocket engine. I've got the book right here. On page... This is Moonshot, right, by Deke Slayton and Al Shepard. Mm-hmm. On page 233, we find this quotation. This is regarding the Apollo 8 mission. They write... At the scheduled moment, Borman, Lavelle, and Anders felt the flaring engine bell hurl forth a long stream of flame, emitting a wide plume of glowing plasma gas behind the engine. Now, it's important to note that the fuels used on the CSM, the command module, the fuels used on that were the same fuels that they used in the ascent stage on the lunar module. So if this engine produces a glowing plasma gas behind the CSM, you'd expect to see a glowing plasma gas behind the ascent engine as it takes off from the moon, and yet we see nothing.
Yeah, but obviously it's a lot less power, so it might be difficult to see with those lenses. Now, this is where I've reviewed this stuff extensively over the last few days, and the Fox film actually got me quite interested, but then I felt quite dirty when I did some further investigation. I found there was quite a few erroneous claims, or they hadn't provided a balanced view. Now, I've seen so far that I think you're reasonably balanced. You're at least prepared to look at the other view. In some cases, you can't get an official view on things, and I think that's where you're very valid asking these questions. Now, what is your take on the Fox piece? Did you think it was actually propaganda to increase interest, but had some quite obvious factual errors?
Well, when I first saw it, it was kind of impressive when I first saw it, but looking back at it, I think, well, they didn't elaborate too much on the various pieces of evidence that it was all faked, which makes it an easy target for people who say it was real.
So it's a straw man.
Well, basically, they present the arguments, right? They present the arguments, but rather than going into detail, okay, here's this, okay, here's the next one. When you present an argument, okay, you present an argument, you elaborate on it, you know, explain why it is correct, okay, then you move on to the subject. These ones, they just presented the argument, okay, then move on to the next subject. Okay, that's my only gripe with the Fox special. They didn't spend enough time on it to prove why these points they bring up are valid, okay, which makes it an easy target for the propagandists.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Now, with the Mythbusters series that they did on the moon landing, which after looking at it, sometimes Mythbusters aren't great, but they're not bad. I actually thought they did a pretty good job on most of the aspects of the moon landing that I thought had holes in them. But the ones that they seem not to touch, some of the ones that you've pointed as your strongest evidence, and they didn't, the things that I think are the strongest evidence, which are the three things that you point out. I'm still frustrated, not really being able to get a clear picture of why we don't have a crater, how they got through the radiation belt, considering the research that you found was done, even though I'd say Wikipedia and other sources on the net paint a picture that to me seems reasonable. They could have got through the belt, but you've cited evidence that says different. I'm wondering why Mythbusters didn't talk about that. And I'm also wondering in general how we explain some of the heat elements on the moon and radiation.
Yeah. It's not just the Van Allen radiation belts that are a major danger to the astronauts. There's also the solar flares.
We probably don't have time to go into that. But could you speak to the Mythbusters and what they did, and if you think they made any mistakes in their analysis? Because I'm sure the viewers who will get the Mythbusters links in the show notes would like to see your view on what they did.
Oh, the Mythbusters show, don't even start on that. That was, the whole program was built on A, botched experiments, and in some cases, B, outright lies. Okay, now, probably the most alarming falsehood in that entire program, you might remember towards the end of the program, they went to the Apache Point Observatory and fired a laser beam at the moon. First they fired it at an uncharted area of the moon, then they fired it at the Apollo 15 site. They say that on three of the Apollo missions, they left these laser-reflecting dishes on the moon to bounce laser beams off these mirrors and back down to Earth.
That's right. It doesn't prove that the man went to the moon, but it might prove that something's on the moon, yeah.
Yeah, well, basically, before they fired at the Apollo 15 site, they fired it at the lunar highland regions, and they say that they got no return signal. Well, they claim, oh, if there was no man-made equipment there, they wouldn't be able to get a signal back. Well, that's just wrong. Okay, there is a if you go to the library, you can get the National Geographic December 1966 issue. In it, you'll find an article called The Laser's Bright Magic by Thomas Molloy. Okay? On page 876, we find this statement. 4 years ago, a ruby laser considerably smaller than those now available shot a series of pulses at the moon 240,000 miles away. The beams illuminated a spot less than 2 miles in diameter and were reflected back to Earth with enough strength to be measured by ultra-sensitive electronic equipment. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, so that means basically these scientists in the U.S., it was at the MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they fired a laser beam off the moon and back to Earth without any reflectors. Now, this was in 1962, okay? A year later, there's a New York Times article in the November 5th, 1963 printing. It's called The Soviet Bounces Light Beam Off Moon in Laser Test. We find that the Soviet Union, they also bounced lasers off the moon using a laser at the observatory in Crimea.
Yeah,
right?
But obviously their test standard, they were firing a laser of a certain power rating in a certain area that didn't have a reflector, then they were getting, you know, 10 dB increase or whatever the reflection was. Yeah. But it was an obvious upmark, and that was the demonstration they were showing. Now, that doesn't prove anything to me because I'm not there to see what they're doing and what equipment they're using. So this is the problem that I have with the moon landing. A lot of it's subjective. Like, we need to trust people with information that they provide, and we can't really demonstrate clearly the situations that we see. We don't have an empirical standard. Say, for instance, if we move on to the moon crater, which is something that intrigues me, because I understand that 1.5 psi pressure wave is considerable and it should move dust. There's no problem with that. I agree with you there, but in the vacuum and in the situation where the plume could be dissipated over a large area, so it's a very even thrust, it is possible, if they did shut it off a little bit early, I know that there's evidence that didn't happen, that maybe it wouldn't have disturbed the surface too much, even though we know empirically that they definitely planned for a crater and we see all this other evidence. But how do we test that situation? Like, how do we get a thruster into a vacuum and actually do some testing on this? Has someone done any of that?
Not that I know of. I imagine what a good test to do would be to get an enormous-sized vacuum chamber and, say, fill the floor with cement, you know, a really hard rock-like simulant, you know, a rock material. You wouldn't even need to hard stuff because, like, it's only runways that are pretty hardened against jet blasts and that sort of stuff. The moon was basically loose terrain. Right, it's basically put a vacuum, get a large.
It's a layer of dust and then hard rock, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a pretty good experiment, just to get the put an engine with the same amount of thrust in the vacuum chamber and put some rock material underneath the engine. You know, do that test in the vacuum chamber.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would be, and that'd be something that would, you know, then would be able to move this debate to a higher level. At this stage, I still see this debate as being subjective, even though there is many of anomalies that you've pointed out, and you're doing quite a good job of explaining. But we're still not at the stage where I think, you know, you could take this to court. Where something like we're looking at the moment with 9/11, we have unexploded ordnance in the dust that we can demonstrate. We've got chain of custody. We've got many samples. We've got buildings falling at free fall speed admitted that is clear evidence, and the media won't even talk about our subject or my particular subject because they know that they can't explain it. But with the moon landing, they always seem to be able to dodge the bullet in one way or another. So what is it, how do you think you're going to get this debate to the next level? How do you think that you're going to take something, you know, to a court, or if you're going to get a group of scientists? We've got 750 architects and engineers that are involved in our campaign. We've got scientific teams that are doing research in labs all around the world. But what have you guys got?
Well, let's see. We've got the photographic evidence. We've got the physical evidence. We've got the scientific evidence. Okay. We've also got, there are actually scientists on our team as well.
Do you have peer-reviewed papers that have been published as such?
Yeah, that's correct. And there's also very...
You do? On which subjects?
Conspiracy theorists also have PhDs, such as Bill Wood and David Groves. They both did some interesting analysis on the rockets and also the engines, respectively.
Yep.
Okay? These were both credentialed experts. Ralph Rene, he was a self-taught engineer, but he was a member of Mensa at one stage. And I would like to just get back to the Mythbusters just for a moment.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
There are two other things that I would like to point out. I mentioned that they did a lot of botched experiments. One of the botched experiments is that they did that jump test with the wires, you know, where they were filming the astronauts with slow motion and also with wires. Well, they're either completely confused about the actual conspiracy theory, or they've intentionally misrepresented it, okay? Because the theory is that the astronauts were filmed on wires, okay? Then they played that footage back in slow motion. They played the wire footage in slow motion, okay? What they did is that they filmed the wires and the slow motion separately, okay? So obviously they're going to screw up the experiment, okay? Here's an interesting thing, right? If you actually take the wire jump...
One second, because I'm a special effects guy. That's what I do by trade. And so you're saying that to botch it, they would have shot at, 50 frames a second, then played back at 30, which is the NTSC standard, or 29.9.
Well, we initially thought that they had filmed it at only half speed. We managed to work out that it was actually 67% speed that they played it at. Here's the thing, right? If you'd actually take the Mythbusters video, right... Yep. And say, of him jumping with the wire, okay, take that video, slow it down to 67% speed, and play it alongside the jump salute, you know, the Apollo video of John Young jumping and saluting the flag, okay, you get a near-perfect synchronization. Okay, the Mythbusters should have done it like that. Okay, instead they shot the wires and slow motion photography separately.
Okay, and how do you explain the feather and the hammer? Was it in a vacuum environment? You're saying they mocked that up?
Well, here's the thing, right? If they were actually shooting this in an environment, okay, the guy, David Scott, wouldn't have been able to grab the feather in the first place, okay? The gloves, they could only...
And that's not answering the question. Like, let's deal with the fact that a feather and a hammer fell in a non-environment, like in a vacuum, together without an effect to the wind. Obviously,
I imagine that they weren't using an actual feather. They were probably using a steel... what's the word I'm looking for? Steel wire thing, you know, that looks like a feather.
Is this from
air resistant, you know?
Can I just interrupt there?
Air resistant.
Yeah, so they could have faked the feather. Okay, well, that's not a bad explanation.
I would just like to get to the major point is the fact that if they're actually on the moon in this vacuum, right, then they wouldn't have been able to hold the feather in the first place because, according to Jan Lundberg, the guy who actually modified the cameras for use with these gloves on, the smallest object the gloves could grip was only one inch. That's how thick the smallest object they could grip with those gloves on, okay? And a feather is obviously much thinner than 1 inch.
Yeah.
But just for our listeners, because, I mean, I'm totally in the dark here about what this is about. So did the astronauts actually... what mission was this on? Which Apollo mission was it?
Apollo 15 with the hammer and feather thing. Basically, towards the end of the third moonwalk on that mission, David Scott, he comes before the camera, takes a hammer and a feather, right, and drops them both at the same height at the same time to try to prove that Galileo was correct, that if there is no air, you know, because a long time ago Galileo worked out that it doesn't matter how heavy an object is, it's what it matters is that the air resistance is, you know, stopping the feather, you know, sooner than... stopping the feather from hitting the ground before the hammer does, basically.
Held a feather and a hammer up and dropped them at the same time, did they?
Yeah, basically. That's what they did, allegedly, in the videos.
Is that on YouTube? Can we watch that footage on YouTube?
Yeah, you can find it on YouTube. In fact, I have a video where I actually disprove this video. It's called A Puff Hitting Happened on the Way to the Moon.
Okay.
Yeah, the air resistance, obviously, is great with a feather at a very light weight. With a hammer, it's not. But if you're in a complete vacuum, mass is mass, and mass will fall at the rate of gravity. So that's the test. Now, this one-inch thing that the glove can't grab, now, is that you can't pick something up that's smaller than 1 inch? Or you're saying that the fingers of the glove will not close than one inch?
Yeah, they won't grip anything.
They won't come together.
An inch.
They won't come together.
They won't come together.
Not in any way.
Not in any way. The smallest thing you can grab is only 1 inch.
Okay. Well, I'll have to take. I'm going to check that out, bud. And okay. Well, that's okay.
I would like to point out, though, a lot of people claim that the shuttle space suits are the same as the Apollo gloves, but they're not. The shuttle gloves are a major improvement over the Apollo gloves. You know, in fact, on the more recent missions, the shuttle missions, remember, the gloves on the shuttle have always been an improvement to those used on Apollo. Just to get the astronauts to grip, you know, tiny screws, they actually had to add additional layers of turtle skin fabric into the fingertips just to increase grip.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, now, if you had to add all this additional layers onto the glove just so they can grab tiny screws, okay, well, why would you need to do that if you could already grab a feather?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair call. I mean, it's a similar size. Anyway, there was one question that you haven't talked about, the Mythbusters. Let's go to the shadows and let's see what it is that... did you think that was a fair test that they did with the shadows, the Mythbusters?
No, I didn't. The shadow, when they're actually filming the astronaut in when he's standing in the shadow of the LEM.
This is the reflected light, yes.
Yeah, what they claim that they were using an albedo of 7%. Well, I doubt they were using that, okay? They said that they were using Portland cement and charcoal powder. Now, Portland cement, that has an albedo of about 22 to 30%,
quite
and
reflective.
Even 90%.
The charcoal's meant to reduce that, but they would have. They were saying that they'd set that up to a standard. Now, I mean, you could say that it's more, it's less, or whatever. We don't really know.
Well,
it's, that's
is
not
they,
conclusive,
they
is it?
They claim they worked it out with a light meter, but they never showed us the numbers on that light meter.
Okay, fair enough. But
now, if they wanted to accurately test the albedo. Sorry, if they wanted to accurately, you know, simulate the conditions on the moon, all they would have needed to do was use asphalt, because asphalt has the same albedo of the moon's surface.
But now, which type of asphalt? Like, is it a certain mix? Like, can you be certain that that's the case?
Well,
that
general... if you go to the American Concrete and Pavement Association, you'll find they have a document which talks about the albedos of asphalt. Like, weathered asphalt has an albedo of 10 to 15%, and new asphalt has an albedo of 7 to 10%. 7 to 10 or 12%.
Okay, is there a way that you can test the lumens that are coming off that with some sort of test equipment? Have you done that? Have you actually tested your test case?
Well, I know. Well, I used asphalt in my test, you know, because
I've seen your test, yeah. But it all gets down to semantics, and I mean, it all gets down to, like, it's subjective, because we don't know exactly whether what you're saying is right, and we don't know whether the asphalt's perfect. But to me, it's debunked, because you get reflected light, and light refracts. And reflects enough so that the subject can be illuminated in a situation where it's in shadow. Do you concede that?
No, I don't think so. What I've done is I did the experiment on asphalt, right, which we know has the same albedo as the moon, okay? Now, to get the astronaut to be adequately lit up without any aid of any additional reflected light or anything like that, without the aid of any fill lights, okay, the only way to expose him correctly would be to open the aperture up all the way to F4. Okay,
yep.
And increase the shutter speed.
Mm-hmm.
But opening it up to F4 in general greatly overexposes the landscape.
Yeah, I saw that you did painstaking work there. I thought it was quite impressive. But we still don't have a test case that we can compare directly, and that's the problem I'm having.
Oh, look,
I'm not saying that you're not onto something.
The fact of the matter is, like, all I want, why hasn't China taken a photo of this stuff? You know, that's what I want to know. Why hasn't some other country taken a photo of the equipment that's left up on the moon? Why do we get one pixel, tiny little silly pixel? I mean, that's all I need. I just want one nice big photo, and that's what you were saying too, Harold, right?
Yeah, look, you know, what we're on about here is truth and justice and, you know, reality. Obviously, we could argue till the cows come home about the photographs. You know, most of it is about a gut feeling. I get a gut feeling from looking at them that they look like they were done in a studio. They're just too perfect, and a lot of people have said that. Then there are all these detailed questions you can have, and then people can debunk every single thing that you claim. Someone else can debunk it, and it's impossible for the average person to come and look at all that and work out what's true and what's false.
Normally,
we're getting back into one of those micro arguments. Now, I watched your presentation on the shadows, on the illumination and the f-stops that you did on the street,
yep.
And I thought you did it pretty well. It looked like you'd done everything you could to create a simulated environment. Now, within what you've got for your resources, you know, mm-hmm. your budget and everything, and compared to what the Mythbusters did, I think it's equally convincing what you've done. Now, it still doesn't prove it one way or the other, but there is an issue there. You know, what I just remember from watching your piece is that when the camera is exposed for the road that you've got the astronaut, you know, you've got this cardboard box,
mm-hmm.
And you've got a toy spaceship, and you've got a toy astronaut, and you've got the sun shining into the box, and you've got a camera at the other end of the box, and it's taking a photograph.
Yes.
And you've got, you do it with several different f-stops. Now, when the camera is exposed for the background, which is the road surface, the astronaut is totally in darkness.
Yes.
When you've got the camera exposed for the astronaut, the road is totally overexposed. Now,
yeah, that's
correct. That you've done that experiment as well as you can. I'm not saying that it proves it, but I think, and John's questions are more about
It makes me interested, but what I'm saying is that in a certain situation, I believe, from what I've seen, that from what Mythbusters have presented and what Jarrah's done, is it's possible that you could have a situation where the camera could take a photo and you get enough lighting from the residual light coming back off the surface to make it work. But whether or not that is the case in this situation, I can't say. I can't do the experiment. But I'm with Josh. I wonder why. We've now got a satellite cruising around the moon. Now, I believe we went to the moon, and I believe man went to the moon at this stage, but I'm interested in your arguments, and I'm not going to say you're nuts for having questions. But,
thank you.
Urban, and I think the people online that do those sorts of things are, you know, not helping anyone. I think they're the people that use the ad hominem, etc., and just knock people for having questions, I think is ridiculous. Anyway, now we've got, at the moment, we've got a satellite going around the moon at about 500 miles out, is that correct, or is it closer than that?
Yeah. Believe it's around that.
Okay, now you know you said you're a photographer, so you have some expertise in this area. At this stage, considering the amount of weight they can lift into orbit around the moon, have they got the facility to take a shot so we could actually see these landers? Do you think that's possible?
Well, normally the explanation is as why we can't see any artifacts on the moon is normally they say, oh, the resolution isn't enough to resolve the artifacts left on the moon. Now, the one that's already up, that's currently up there, it's called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Now, that one has a resolution of about 5 meters per pixel, which means the smallest object you can see is, half a meter per pixel.
Half a meter, okay.
Yes. Yeah. The smallest object you can see is about half a meter wide. So each pixel represents half a meter. Okay.
That's not accurate enough for what we want.
Mm. Well, they say they should. They've been hoping that it should have been able to see the lunar modules because they're like four or five meters wide, and yet you always see these tiny little pixels, which in fact resemble boulders. Now,
they're inconclusive photos.
I would like to point out as well is that if they wanted to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was anything up there, all they would need to do is go down to the Gemini Observatory. You see, I interviewed Geoff Hawthorne, who was the who's the Anglo Australian Observatory's head of instrument science. I interviewed him in 2006. He specifically told me that they had a telescope at the Gemini Observatory that could see the artifacts left behind on the moon. He said all they needed was adaptive optics, you know, to overcome the distorting effects of the atmosphere. You need these adaptive optics on the telescope to overcome this distortion, you know, of the light showing through, like the twinkling, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay. They've got these optics currently installed on the telescope, and well, I'm still waiting for them to find the module. I have never received any word on them finding anything.
And there does seem to be some silence around some of these issues, which intrigues me.
Yeah, but honestly, you know, these 0.5 of a meter per pixel photography kits, they're basically set up for like Google Earth style, you know, massive, vast area photography. Why can't we just zoom in and to exactly that spot and just take a good shot? I mean, it's just obscene, folks.
Look, I just can't believe, because I know that satellite imagery is very, very high resolution. I just don't understand why we can't get high-res images. Don't understand that.
Yeah. Anyways, at the bottom line is, what I would like to point out is the fact that the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, at the end of the day, even if it does have any, you know, good photographs, at the end of the day, it's not a NASA. It's not an independent verification because it's a NASA spacecraft.
Well, indeed. What about the Japanese and the Chinese? Because they've both had satellites up there, haven't they?
Well, yeah, they do have satellites up there. But unfortunately, the Japanese and the Japanese are part of NASA's international network. You see, they're all working together on the International Space Station, and the Chinese, they're America's, you know, best free trade partners. Now, a number of independent private companies have actually, you know, gone into space now, joining the space race. If a private company who is completely devoid of any connections with NASA is able to photograph the artifacts on the moon, then we'll have the independent verification that we need.
Okay.
So far, there hasn't been any independent verification.
Okay, the objects are visible. The locations on the moon are visible from the Earth. I'm not quite sure what so the moon always faces the Earth, is that right?
And yeah, well, that's correct.
It doesn't rotate on its own axis.
Right, yeah.
The rotation of the moon takes exactly the same as it takes to orbit the Earth. So,
okay, yeah.
Yeah, so we always see this one side.
And it's exactly the right distance to cause the solar eclipse, which is also very strange, but it's all part of the...
Yeah, that's an odd one, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly the right...
It's a fascinating thing, the moon.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we should be able to see those images either from an Earth-based telescope, or what about the Hubble?
Well, they always claim that the Hubble... It's an interesting story behind that. They actually said that the Hubble could see a firefly will see, make out the light from a firefly at the distance of the moon, but they say, no, it doesn't have enough resolution. They say the smallest object you can see is only about 60 meters wide, which is obviously too...
Okay.
Yeah, too big to see anything.
Okay, yeah. Well... Gee, it'd be a great project for someone, you know, for some country to do, to just get something up there so we could have a look at, you know, it'd be a great propaganda victory again, I think, to be able to see. I mean, the buggy. I mean, there's a buggy up there, isn't there, supposedly?
Yeah, there was three lunar rovers. Yeah. Three lunar rovers that they brought up
Yeah,
there.
Now, I had this question, right?
Yeah. How did they get it out of
there? How the hell did they get the buggies up there? These things are massive.
Yeah, the buggy, basically, from what I understand, the wheels, they fold inward, and it's mounted on the one side of the lunar module. It doesn't actually go in the cabin.
So it was actually mounted, okay, right.
It's mounted on the side of the lunar module.
They didn't
like
have to
camera.
Pull it out, yeah.
Well, it's like IKEA style, you know, flat-packed.
There's one note here that I've got that I think we should point out, that it was something I disagree with you said earlier about the structure of the module. Now, you were saying that the heat could be transferred. Now, the only energy that you can get from the sun without any atmosphere or in a vacuum is purely, it must be radiated. So the light must hit the surface, am I right?
That's correct.
Okay, so if no light gets inside the module, then it doesn't get hot.
Well, it hits the side of the module, right?
It hits the aluminium, but if there's two layers of aluminium and there's a vacuum in between, then it doesn't transfer. Is that right?
Actually, no. There's a vacuum in between the shuttle spacesuits. There's no vacuum in between the Apollo spacecraft.
Okay, so what did it have? It was obviously a bilayered structure, wasn't it? There was two layers.
Yeah,
it was just an
air. Basically a steel frame on a covered in foil, basically.
Okay, but was there two layers of foil?
It was as thick as two layers of foil. I don't know if they had two layers of foil on it.
Well, they must have, or it would have got very, very hot, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would have gone very hot, yeah.
But the reflectivity of the foil, it was specifically designed to reflect heat and not retain it, wasn't it?
Well, even if you reflect the heat, there's still going to be an amount that gets through. In fact, Collins once said that without any way to cool the thing, an astronaut would actually dissolve in a pool of sweat.
Well, when you heat something up in the oven, you've got foil tin foil around it, does get hot, doesn't it? So I'm questioning. I think you made that argument a little bit too strong. From my point of view, like what we've been doing with the 9/11 Truth Movement, we're very, very cautious about making statements that are in any way dubious, because we've got some really serious evidence. And I think you've got a few things that have got me interested. I'm still not convinced, but. But anyway,
well, if you want really physical evidence, you just look back to Gemini 12 when Buzz Aldrin nearly burned himself against the zipper on his face.
Well, of course the zipper's going to get hot, but he wasn't meant to be leaning against it, was he?
No, he wasn't meant to be leaning against it. But even so, an astronaut can get extremely hot doing very simple tasks in the Gemini.
Well, he can't get rid of the contained heat energy from his body, and that was what we were talking. You were mentioning about the air conditioning system that and then purges the moisture so that he doesn't fog up. I mean, it's all very, very complicated stuff. But I mean, Herod
needs some Gore-Tex. That's what they need.
Well, they've invented Velcro for the NASA program, but that's something that's become very useful. But one contextual thing I'd like to bring up, that Herod talked about that era of the 60s, which was an era of deception, obviously, with the John F. Kennedy.
Massive. You know, there's lots of... that's why we're totally justified.
Yeah,
because
it's in that era of time, it's, you know, we're very, very suspect of nearly everything that happened during that period. But the one thing I would say is that at that time, America was at its greatest as far as being able to use labor and its knowledge. Like, it's definitely not as powerful a nation now as it was then. It had, like, this real desire to be the best in the world, and the people were really compelled to work hard, and, you know, they were fit, they were young, they were smart. But really, the America we see today is nothing really, nowhere near as talented. And I've often thought that the reason they never went back to the moon was because they just didn't have the tenacity they had back in the 60s. And also, something I think needs to be brought up is that I know for a fact that by the time the sixth module landed on the moon, no one gave a shit anymore. Everybody was pretty much over it. They'd run their course. The reason they stopped using it as a propaganda exercise was there were much better ways to make money than stripping the budget out of the NASA, because obviously a lot of big corporations made a lot of money out of going to the moon. There'd be no doubt about that. But they seem to just lose interest in it because the media had lost interest in it.
In fact, if you recall, on Apollo 12, even though they were supposed to bring a color TV camera on that mission, it got burned out, of course. Even though they were supposed to bring in some color TV, by that time, when people were actually calling up the networks and complaining that reruns of I Love Lucy were cancelled.
Yeah, that's right. So it's good. Yeah, it's good to see you, and good to see you, agree on that point that they were, most people were over it, and I think that's the most likely reason they wrapped it up.
The Apollo 13 flight did manage to get some interest back in the moon program, though, but after a while they became bored again. Yeah, but either way, the Apollo 13 mission definitely resulted in a way of how they could get out of, you know, continue to fake moon flights. Okay, we've completed the objective, now let's get out of it by, you know, making...
Yeah, that's subjective, but that's an interesting aside.
Yeah. So, what's next for you, Jarrah? Have you got any projects? Are you going to make a full-scale documentary? Anything interesting you're planning?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm just finishing up a documentary about the Apollo 1 fire, and I also plan on adapting Ralph Renné's book to video. Ralph Renné, he wrote the book NASA Mooned America. He passed away last year, very sadly.
Okay.
I plan on adapting his book to video. He had probably the most compelling book about the moon hoax. For every statement that he makes, he has a valid footnote behind it to back it up.
Okay. Yeah. I just should say for the audience, the Apollo 1 fire, a lot of people don't know about it. I had sort of forgotten about it. There was this horrendous fire. Three astronauts were killed on the launch pad. Mm-hmm. And the family of the astronauts, or the families of at least one of the astronauts, are not happy. They don't think it's been properly investigated, and they think it was deliberate. Is that? I mean, I saw a video clip where some of his family members are saying that. Is that correct?
That's correct. The family member you're talking about is from the Grissoms. Grissom. Grissom is the son of Virgil Gus Grissom. He believes that the fire was set intentionally. In fact, in 1999, he was granted access to his father's spacecraft, and he found evidence that a metal plate had been shoved behind the dashboard to deliberately trigger a spark. Okay.
This is a shocking allegation. I mean, the families of NASA astronauts, you'd expect they would stand by the creed and for them to be questioning it is an incredibly important thing. I'm surprised it hasn't been talked about.
But quite often with these technical type missions, you'd find that if they did a coronial investigation of the fire, they would find safety faults within the vehicle because they were at great risk, these astronauts. You know, they basically signed up, a possible death sentence with what they were doing. And I think that'd be the counterclaim, was that they didn't want any investigation because it would uncover flaws in the mission. And also would probably bring technologies to light that were secret. So, there's probably an explanation why they didn't, but it is definitely true that the families never received a proper investigation.
I'll tell you something about that fire. There's a whole lot of shady stuff behind it, okay?
Okay.
Here's a taste of what you're in for my next film.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Now, the guy who they elected to lead the investigation was Frank Borman, who would later fly on Apollo 8, their first mission around the moon. Now, this guy, he was an assistant professor in thermodynamics, okay? He was he's the guy who knows about energy transfer, all this sort of stuff, and I'm sure some of you might know that in thermodynamics classes, they actually have a bomb calorimeter in which they put a sample inside an oxygen chamber and they, ignite it, okay? So the Apollo capsule was very similar to that, in which they had all these astronauts inside this capsule sealed with 16 or 20 PSI, depending on who you ask. PSI pure oxygen, 20 PSI pure oxygen, okay?
Yeah, which is substantially above the standard temperature, standard pressure of 14.7. So, yeah, pressurized oxygen environment, perfect for fire. You there?
Propaganda. Disinformation. Misinformation. Deception. Deceit, spin, untruths, half-truths, lies, the truth. Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au.
Okay, we're just back from a little technical glitch there. Are you there, Jarrah?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah,
excellent.
You read me.
Excellent. Thank you. We read you absolutely better than Buzz Aldrin could at this point.
So we're just talking about the atmosphere inside the fire zone. It was a pressurized, oxygen-rich environment. So carry on.
Yeah, well, basically, depending on who you ask, the pressure inside that was either 16 PSI or 20 PSI. Frank Borman, he claims it was 20 PSI. But anyways, this guy, he was an assistant professor in thermodynamics, right? He clearly knows that this is going to be a hazardous test, right, because he's done all these, bomb calorimeter experiments, right? And he testifies before Congress, and he says, I don't believe that any of us recognized that the test was going to be hazardous. It wasn't classified as hazardous, basically, right? Yet in the same testimony, he then states that, oh, we are very aware of the fires at Johnsville Navy Air Station and also at Brooks Air Force Base. See, before the Apollo 1 fire, NASA and the US government, they had all these pure oxygen experiments, right? And each one of them turned into a disaster. Like, one of them, this guy was fixing a light bulb, right? And it burst into flames and created a flash fire. They tried to extinguish it with an asbestos fire blanket, and guess what? The fire blanket caught on fire.
Well, that's everything changes. It's you know, it's thermal rating when it's in an oxygen environment. I deal with oxygen at work all the time. Normally, you've got 21% oxygen in air, and if you're at 20 psi, which is a considerable amount above standard pressure, and it's all oxygen, I can imagine things would a lot of things would burn that people would wouldn't normally suspect would burn. Basically, most of the stuff inside that module would have been able to burn with that much oxygen present.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also various other conflicting statements, okay, is that Frank Borman, he claims that no one at NASA was aware of the fire hazard, yet Buzz Aldrin, he wrote a book called Men from Earth, and in that book he states that, oh, we were aware of the risk, but we considered it acceptable because in space we could instantly depressurize the cabin. Now, hold on a second. You either knew it was hazardous or you didn't. Which is it?
Okay. Oh, yeah. I mean, these things are normal in these sorts of, these guys were pushing, boundaries, and they have to lie, or, they believe they have to lie about things to get the job done. So, I mean, I don't find that particularly unusual, not with some of the things we've uncovered with what the government and the military will say to do what it is they want to do. You know, they'll create whole false flag events to get their agendas happening.
And then, of course, there's also North American aviation. You see, there were two groups involved in the Apollo 1 thing. There was, first of all, there was NASA, who was trying to launch this thing, and then there was North American Aviation, who actually built the spacecraft, you see. Now, what North American Aviation, what they were claiming now is that, oh, we thought NASA was doing this test at only 5 psi, not 20 psi, right? Yet in 1964, remember the fire was in 1967, right? In 1964, one of their engineers, Frank Hendel, he submitted an article in the Journal of Spacecraft and Rockets. The article is called Gaseous Environment During Space Missions. It's published in the July-August 1964 issue. Okay, in that article, he specifically states that oxygen presents a fire hazard, which is especially great on the launching pad with the cabin when the cabin is purged with oxygen at 14.7 psi.
Standard
pressure. This guy at North American Aviation, he clearly knew that NASA does these tests at sea level pressure in pure oxygen, yet now they're claiming that they thought NASA was doing the test at only 5 psi.
Yeah.
They're covering their asses, it seems.
Yeah, well, that's it's quite interesting. It'd be good to get these sorts of things into some sort of inquiry.
So which launch was this?
This was Apollo 1, you see. This was going to be an Earth orbit flight, the first manned flight of the Apollo spacecraft. They had Virgil Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee. Virgil Grissom, he was the first American to return to space. He was the first American astronaut to return to space. He had flown Liberty Bell 7 and also Gemini 3. Edward White was the first American spacewalker. He flew Gemini 4. And Roger Chaffee, Apollo 1, was to be his first space flight.
Wow. Well, you certainly know your stuff, Jarrah, and I think it's one of it's a very important thing that you're doing, and I congratulate you on the work that you've done and all your videos and all your hard work. And I think the pursuit of truth is a very virtuous one, and it's fantastic to see such good work.
Look, we're going to have to wind it up here. Can we just get like a quick roundup for you of your websites? Just so people can follow that.
Okay, sure. You can go onto moonmovie.com and moonhoax.us. Those are the websites that I'm contributing editor to.
Okay.
You can also go onto YouTube and do a search on White Jarrah. You'll find my account. My account is White Jarrah. It used to be Jarrah White, but after it got suspended the first time, I had to change it to White Jarrah. You can find all my Moonfaker videos on there. You can go onto live video/Jarrah. You find all my flagging the gems videos there.
Great.
I also recommend the BillCasing.com website. That's the website made in honor of Bill Casing, the grandfather of the Apollo hoax theory.
Excellent. And look, we'll put all those on the show notes. And
there's a couple of good debunking sites too that are fair.
Yeah.
That I'll give you some links to that I got from some people in the US that have looked into this.
We'll put those on the show notes as well.
They're skeptics of the hoax. But they do say there are some interesting anomalies.
Great.
Yeah, no, honestly, I think it's fantastic work, and we always, to keep in a free society, you must always distrust what governments tell you, and you must always study for yourself, and don't believe one source. Really, go folks out there and you know, figure it out for yourself. Once again, please visit truthnews.com.au, folks, and tell your friends.
Yeah, and please, anyone who wants to argue this point about the moon landings, we welcome the questions. Get in touch with Jared directly, or leave notes on our site. And Jared, thanks so much for coming on. It was excellent. I hope we can talk to you again sometime.
I hope so too. The pleasure was all mine. Maybe we'll get an interview after I release my Apollo 1 video. I'd like to talk more on that.
Okay, we'll do it. We'll have you back on when you've done that.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, and good night, Jarrah.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.